I am a poor wayfaring stranger, while traveling through this world of woe. Yet there's no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I know dark clouds
Welcome to Tea Time Theology. I'm Ivy Swinsky.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dwayne Keyes from Church of the Redeemer.
And I'm Patrick Campbell from Church of the Redeemer.
And we are so excited to have Ray Watson back. They're the CEO of the Providence Cultural Equity Initiative. Thank you so much for giving us even more of your time.
Very honored to be here, and I'm looking forward to a very lively discussion today.
Yeah. So last time we had you here, we talked about sort of the history of urban renewal in Providence. And today I'd really like us to look at how do these policies still impact what is happening today in the state of Rhode Island. If you want to take it out to the world, you can, but we'll start in Providence.
Sure. So in 2021, my company, Providence Cultural Equity Initiative, we were contracted in collaboration with Roger Wood University by the city of Providence to conduct the reconciliation phase of Mayor Jorge Alorza's Truth-Telling, Reconciliation, and Reparations Initiative. Very honored to have engaged that work. And one of the key focuses of what we decided to do was look at how the legacy of urban renewal was still impacting today. So in that regard, we reached out to individuals that we were aware of who had lived through that urban renewal experience, to ask them how they thought that was impacting on today. And one of the key elements that came out of it was that it had disrupted communities, torn apart families, and that a lot of the issues that we see going on contemporarily in our society, be it lack of achievement, be it impoverishment, whatever the case may be, people connected it directly to urban renewal. There was a gentleman who I used to converse with very frequently, who passed away a number of years ago. His name was Gary Perry, from the Perry family, very prominent family up on the East Side. But Gary, whenever we would talk, inevitably his conversation would point back to what they did to the community with University Heights, and how the community was so vibrant before then, and how, and this is the part that used to always get me, you know, after they took the Heights from us, they introduced all of the drugs into the community. So, you know, they messed the community up, then they dumped drugs on us. And then after that, they threw all of these drug laws on us, you know, so then we started going to, and you could just see step by step by step how you get to where we're at today. Now, what's so important about that is urban renewal isn't that long ago, 60 years ago, maybe? Mm-hmm. So there are people around today who lived through that and have that stained on their psyche, have that as kind of their view of what this city thinks about their community. And then you have generations after that who don't grow up in a community where there's doctors, where there's lawyers, where there's dentists. They grow up in a community where their father went to jail. They grow up in a community where everyone's on Section 8 and welfare, so there's no money around. They grow up in a community where, you know, you just don't have a large a lot of opportunity. Dwayne talked about the school system. They grow up in a community where education isn't really an option because you're going to one of the worst school systems in the country. So what do you expect to be the outcome, and how are those outcomes impacting the city and the state and society generally today? So when we're talking about the legacy of urban renewal, I think that you have to look at what's going on in Black and brown communities today and look at what the impact of having communities literally torn apart. I mean, we interviewed an individual who said his family was so impacted by urban renewal here in Lippitt Hill and on the east side that they moved completely out of the state down to Maryland because they just wanted to get away. They felt so...
abandoned?
Yeah, but beyond that, because, you know, abandonment is we're just going to leave you alone. They felt victimized.
Mm.
You know, like they were intentionally targeted for what happened. They were lied to around what the benefit would be. You know, they had their land taken from them, like everything, and they just wanted to get away. But when we spoke to him, one of the things he said was, and this was part of the recommendations we made, if there was some sort of program that would provide some resources and support for him to be able to purchase a home back in this community today, he would do it.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed a woman, Deacon Joyce Thorne, yesterday. And one of the things that she talked about was how she still wishes, she believes that a lot of the Black community who was impacted by that still wish that they had their own church. You know, so all of these things speak to a legacy of what was ours was taken away from us, and we haven't been made whole by that. So when I look at any of the issues that we're talking about, when you're talking especially about our young folks, I got children now, so I'm very cognizant of, you know, how I conduct myself reflects to them. I'm looking back now what my mother went through, what my father went through, what my grandmother went through. And I'm like, oh, I get it now. You all were trying to deal with something that happened to a generation before you, and this was the best you could do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you passed that on to the next generation who, looking at what you went through, tried to figure things out the best that they could. So if my property's taken away, now I need to figure out a way to make money. Now drugs are dumped into the neighborhood. Drugs are a way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
But now, and this generation is making money, they're going to jail. So now the next generation, which is my generation, oh, so you can make money with drugs, but you might go to jail. That's just normalized now. So I don't think that there's anything crazy about selling drugs and going to jail. What does the next generation think? Well, everyone goes to jail. Everyone's going to jail sometime. Everyone sells drugs. School? What do you mean school? You have to sell drugs. So you can see how the psyche gets warped to normalize things that the greater society says, well, why are you all doing that? You shouldn't be doing that. It's crazy that you're doing that. Go to school. Get a job. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
You mean the same bootstraps that you got your subsidized housing and funding and money? And that's the one thing that goes on, like, with my workshops and teachings that I do in terms of the legacies of racism when it comes to economic justice. United for a Fair Economy has this great image where it shows government boosts and blocks to wealth building. And they show on the top the boosts and then who benefited with the boosts. And the majority of the boosting is going to who? White people. And then at the bottom, it shows the blocks. And they break it down as to what laws or policies were passed that impacted the indigenous community, those of African heritage, those of Latino descent, and then even Asian descent. And it goes there from the founding of this nation even through today of those boosts and blocks. And that's just the federal level.
Yeah.
As we know, state and local tend to follow suit of federal policy.
Yeah, and you're also sort of feeding in, you didn't say this specifically, so I'm going to say it specifically, the cliff effect, where people like reach a certain... you're looking at me like you don't know what I'm talking about. where people reach a certain like economy level,
yeah.
But then that means they lose all of their subsidies.
Absolutely.
Because they get that like 3% raise, but then now they can't afford their house.
Exactly. So we have a public benefit system where they're put in place where you either stay poor, remain poor, and if, yes, you dare to try to be economically mobile in any way, shape, or form, yes, the system is set up where it is a penalization. Mm-hmm. There's a firm cutoff, not a gradual reduction. Mm.
You said that so much better than I just did.
I mean, again, as someone who's been a financial coach who supports people who are in subsidized housing, the Cliffs effect, the benefit Cliffs effect, that is real and true.
Yeah.
So when they're getting this great job and, oh, you're going to save your rent increases at this program. And, oh, your SNAP benefits, that got cut. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, you don't qualify for a child care voucher anymore. Mm-hmm. No. Yes, your subsidy as your income has increased, then your subsidy is reduced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I work with a lot of, like, moms getting back into the workforce after having children. And a lot of them just, like, it doesn't make economic sense because they can't afford the child care.
And I mean, when you think about these systems, yes, there is an element that we set it up so that Black and brown folks are excluded from benefiting from those systems. So when Social Security was first issued out, you have to remember there were certain occupations that were excluded from being eligible for Social Security benefits. And the majority of those types of occupations had been filled by who? Black people. So no, you're not eligible for that benefit. Or if your spouse, generally it was the husband who worked, he was doing farm work. Oh, no, that doesn't qualify. So that Black woman widow would not benefit or get that Social Security payment versus the white woman widow would, because the occupation that her white husband had fulfilled met the criteria.
Do you think, this is completely off topic, but you made me think about it. Do you also think that this feeds into the like resurgence we've seen, or just surgence of charter schools?
Yeah, so I think we have to look at everything that's being pushed wholesale by government and by policymakers very, very in-depthly. And once again, as Dwayne said in our last discussion, we can't look at what the intention is. I think as soon as you hear, well, this is what we're intending to do, but what's the outcome going to be? And I say this as someone who's on the board of a charter school. And the reason I'm on the board of that charter school is because my daughter is going to that charter school, and I can't help myself, like, when it comes to
No, you have to.
The reason that we chose the charter school, it's a bilingual charter school, so I definitely wanted to have that experience. But the elementary school she was slated to go to, I was like Providence Public School System, so. But we went and visited the elementary school, and her classroom was going to be so big. There was going to be like 25 students in her classroom, and this was like kindergarten. And I was like, eh.
And that's small because they can go up to 30.
Well, you know, so that was it. But then when we got there, I saw that, because I have a tendency to run my mouth and complain, you know. So when we got there, I don't know if the word went out that I was coming to visit, but the teacher in the classroom spent all her time with my wife and I talking to us around how great of an experience my daughter would have. And I'm looking at these Latino parents and these Black parents, and there's no attention getting paid to them. And I'm saying to myself, no, because I can already see that you're not even paying attention to most of the students. You're paying attention to the squeaky wheel. And does that mean that I'm going to have to be up here all the time being a squeaky wheel for my daughter who's in kindergarten? Now, this is an elementary school where a child had bullets in their bag a couple of months ago. This is the elementary school that's next to the middle school where there was a student there who had a gun that they didn't tell anyone in the community. So from my perspective as the parent, she was going to go there, and then at the last minute, hey, we have an extra slot at this charter school, Nuestro Mundo, public charter school. It's right on the south side. Would you like your daughter to go there? Of course. So from that perspective, while I can see, once again, the benefit of the charter school because I'm directly benefiting from it, the issue is the students who can't go to a charter school, who have to be in that environment where there's 30 kids. And I don't know if any of you have dealt with, like, kindergarten age, all of them need your attention immediately right now.
Yeah.
So I can just imagine what it would be like to be a teacher and even having TAs, but to have 30 little people who all need your attention fully and wholly immediately, what type of stress that would be.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can just imagine how that plays out on the psyche of young folks who are in that environment where all day that attention that you need, you can't get just because the resources aren't there, because you're one of 30. So if this kid hits you and you're trying to tell the teacher, maybe she can't get to you. So now what do you get in your mind? Well, I'll hit him back. And now as a young person, you've developed this mentality that you hit people back. Well, how does that play out when you get into middle school? How does, and you can see, once again, because of the policy that's being put in place, because of the support that's being given, how it starts to impact the actual people and what the generational outcomes are. So, yeah, to answer your question, yes, I think it's something that we need to pay attention to. I'm not against charters, but I think that we also need to take a comprehensive view and don't do the pendulum thing that, well, since the public school's having issues, we'll just dump everything.
Yeah.
What's best for the community,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how do you balance that? And more importantly, who are you speaking to figure that out?
But one of the things too, and I remember when I first started working for Compass, we would do these lunch and learns, and there was this research paper, white paper it was called, ironically, called The Asset Value of Whiteness. And I remember walking with my then executive director, CEO, she's like, come on, Dwayne, we're going to the lunch and learn. I'm looking, we going to have lunch on this? We going to talk about this? But in that, one of the things that was talking about is that because of the devaluing of black people and black bodies and the upholding of whiteness as a virtue, as a value to uphold, you see, even with the private public schools, a disinvestment. There would be no state takeover and none of the issues we would see with private public schools if the community, the students going there were predominantly white.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's keep it real.
Mm-hmm.
You would have never seen this. You would have saw responses like you see in Barrington and other predominantly white communities when there's an issue with the school. Everything is all immediately handled, taken care of, and addressed. And even when we see right now through the city of Providence, as we're having, you know, predominantly wealthy or well-to-do people who majority are white, coming in, moving into the city of Providence, stuff and things that black and brown folks have been asking for years get ignored. All of a sudden, we got some good, nice white folks moving in. We need to do some investment and do some attention. Mm-hmm. So you see the disparity in terms of treatment of people living here based on race.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not by law, but the reality is you have folks who are in power, in these positions of influence, those who are the government workers who, by the way that they just interact and do things, are being or engaging in racist behavior and tactics and treatment. Yeah.
In the work that we do with PCEI, when we look at the concept of racism, we look at four different levels of it. The highest degree is that person who's got the white hood on, who's burning a cross on your lawn, calling you the N-word, right? And nobody likes those type of racists, right? But those are not, in our opinion, the most prominent or the most impactful racists. So we look at the first level is the, you know, the, and you know, we go, a lot of black women go, oh, your hair is so nice. Mm-hmm. And then the touching of the hair. So it, that could be from someone like who grew up in Idaho, never met a black person before. And they're like, and it's just this sort of unintentional, but still the outcome is what it is, form of racism where simply because you've never been around this community, you just don't know. So you're doing things that are offensive, that but you don't know about it. The second form is when you're confronted with the fact that this behavior is inherently racist and your response is, well, no, it's not, because now you've been informed. And instead of taking that information and saying, OK, how do I address my behavior so that that doesn't happen? You start trying to justify and excuse what you're doing. And we know some of those people, but they usually get called out. The most, in our opinion, impactful and dangerous form of racism is the systemic form where, well, no one's actually doing that to you because you're black, but this is happening to you because you're black and it's nobody's fault. So when we look at the takeover, right? Well, the numbers say this and the report said that and this is what took place. So we need to do this for the good of our students. But how did these things get to that place in the first place? And who was held accountable that they got to that place? Mm-hmm. And no one, right? Because new administration now, right? So you can't go after the old folk who were doing this. This new administration's here. This new administration, well, they don't want to get caught up in what the past administration was. And they've got their focus on, so they're going to do this, which now leads to this. And then they're gone and a new administration comes in. So it's nobody's fault, technically, that this situation is the way that it is. But we now have one of the worst school districts in the nation. And I'll share this as well. I was heavily involved in when the teacher's contract was going on. In all of the discussion around that. And several people in the community, they reached out. I spoke at press conferences and all that. And the community was very, very clear on what their concerns were and what they wanted to see in that teacher's contract. And what ended up happening? A closed door meeting between the union and the governor and the commissioner, and everything that the community said that they didn't want was just rammed down their throat. Mm-hmm. Now, you can look at that, and if you want to say, well, that wasn't because they were black and brown folk. That was because of the circumstances and the economy. But to Duane's point, no, that was because they were black and brown folk, because that would not have happened in a barrier. You cannot have a unified, clear voice from the people that you're saying you always want to hear from. And then in order to do what you want to do anyway, a closed door meeting that they're not invited to, where you do what you want anyway, and say that that's not because of this.
And then also, to that point, thinking about involved, you know, we had this term, skin folk. You have to remember, all skin folk ain't kin folk.
Goodness.
Because there are a number of black and brown people who are also engaging in this activity because for whatever reason, they did not have, live, or even think or share that experience that we're talking about. And so they think that what we're doing is also best. Mm-hmm. So that's also what's mm-hmm. playing here in Providence, where you do have a number of people. Again, some folks, and I put myself here, I'm now, I would say, a Rhode Islander, mm-hmm. you know, haven't been here half my life, 25 years. But there was a moment in time where you have a lot of folks like me who come here who do not have the humility, mm-hmm. who did not have a similar experience. Mm-hmm. Again, coming up from Wilmington, Delaware, the second smallest mm-hmm. state in town, you saw it, you lived it, you saw other mm-hmm. folks who were not from here coming here, getting mm-hmm. these jobs, benefiting, working for DuPont, and then mm-hmm. here I am. I can't even get mm-hmm. the opportunity to work in those companies, but in here, I'm thriving as well. Mm-hmm. And so you see that scenario where they are utilizing those mm-hmm. folks to then say, wait a minute, no, things are great. Look mm-hmm. at someone like Duane. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Look at someone, mm-hmm. again, the person who's been here all their life, why are they struggling? Mm-hmm. They should be farther ahead. I should be struggling mm-hmm. as the one not originally from here. Mm-hmm. You would think that concept. Yeah. And another thing is, it's all good until someone like me starts to then ask those mm-hmm. questions. So it was great as I was, you know, I was chairperson of the South Providence Neighborhood Association for almost 8 years. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, to have that one black person out of how many other neighborhood leaders who was under 40 at the time, who was black, who was dark complected. Oh, great. Let's talk to him. Let's make sure mm-hmm. we have that. And in the moment, I started asking a lot of questions mm-hmm. and challenging thoughts and policies mm-hmm. on the comprehensive plan on zoning. Again, mm-hmm. these things that were utilized when it comes to mm-hmm. urban renewal, all of a sudden, well, you know, mm-hmm. we need to, let's mm-hmm. not go on yeah. over there. Mm-hmm. Let's hopefully he don't find out. Yeah. So there are these, again, these actions, these things that are done in a way in which we're still perpetuating exclusion yeah. and harm of mm-hmm. black people.
Can yeah. you, one of you, whoever wants to jump in, talk a little bit about how zoning still impacts the world?
Uh-huh. So we got a tremendous example going on right now, right here in Mount Hope.
We do.
There is, and I know I chaired the board for the Mount Hope Community Center. So we have, since I was ED, man, I started the ED in 2006, and I was there to 2016. But during that time period, I had tried at several attempts to initiate conversation with the Mount Hope Land Trust about doing some development at the bus turnaround, which is right on Camp Street. The housing market hit, and then that kind of conversation just got pushed to the back because we were just scrambling to make ends meet. Fast forward about 10, 15 years, the center's being run by Helen Dukes, doing a tremendous job. But she's able to get possession of the bus turnaround from the land trust. So now we're in a position where we want to look at what can we do with that bus turnaround to address, in particular, affordable housing because of the legacy of gentrification and displacement going back to urban renewal. Helen has a conversation, and I know this because I'm the board chair, she let me know, with a certain developer who was just inquiring what the center was looking to do in the neighborhood. And she mentions, you know, our interest in the bus turnaround. Well, lo and behold, a couple weeks ago, I get contacted by some people in the community. Do you know that they're trying to build a 50-unit housing development across the street from the bus turnaround? And so I'm like, first of all, a 50-unit on this small? Well, who's going to move into a 50-unit? College kids. Airbnb rental. So I'm like, whoa, whoa. But then I'm like, hold on a second. Wait a minute. We're trying to do a development for affordable housing. So why would they try to do this right across the street? Who's the... Oh, that's the developer that Helen... Oh, okay. Well, they've already gone to the committee and they already got a recommendation that this be... So when we talk about zoning, once again, spot zoning is supposed to be illegal. Spot zoning is when you look at the comprehensive plan for area, you say, yeah, but we're going to do this here because whatever the reason is. And we know it doesn't really fit with what the general goal is for it, but we're going to do it anyway. All of the units around there, even the multifamily ones, 12, 16 maybe units in there. So where are you getting 40 to 50 from? And why would there be a recommendation for 40 to 50 in a primarily residential neighborhood? And why wasn't there any community engagement done around? Like, how do we even get this far in the process if there's zoning laws there? Now, on the flip side, what do you think Mount Hope's having to go through to explore the potential to develop at the bus turnaround? Well, we need an environmental impact study because Ripta owns a piece there. And have you done your community engagement? You know, you're going to need community engagement because if we don't get community engagement, because you're looking like maybe you want to go up from three floors to floor, you know, you're going to need to. So we're being held to a very strict procedure, as we should be. But a developer for a project right across the street from us, who's well beyond what is normal for the neighborhood, is like three-fourths of the process through, where now they're putting up signs saying, protesting and arguing and having to call politicians. So I say all that to say, zoning is so impactful today because it's used as a tool to hold back the people we want to hold back. But the developments by the developers that we want to see move forward, well, we can let this slide and you can get a variance on that. So it's like this tool that is an offensive weapon against what we don't want to see happen. And then it's like a buffer and like a facilitator for things that we want to see happen. So put that on affordable housing, right? Right now, as I understand it, three-family homes are considered under zoning laws commercial properties. So if you want to build a three-family, there's all of this extra stuff you need to do. And why? Well, because of safety, because of fire hazard. But three-family homes would address the affordable housing situation that's going on. So why wouldn't you allow more three-family structures where you could have... Who made that decision? The other discussion, and this is part of what I was pushing back on, this notion, and now because affordable housing is the buzz, well, we need affordable housing and density, you know, is a, yeah, cool, cool, cool. But why are you focusing on Mount Hope for this type of affordable housing and density? I'm sure that there's some space on this side of Hope Street that could perhaps, you know, so why aren't we focusing down on Elm Grove Ave? I'm sure, you know, and then when you look into it, the areas they want to focus on, Mount Hope and South Providence. Oh, well, this is interesting. What do Mount Hope and South Providence have in common that maybe makes them the area where you want to try this density stuff at, as opposed to the other side of Hope Street, that end of Hope Street, you know? And then I even brought up, well, why wouldn't we do this down on North Main Street, where you've got a Charles Gate? You've got, well, developers don't want to build on North Main Street. Oh, okay. So this isn't even about the zoning then. This is about what developers, well, who are these developers and why are they choosing to develop? So this is where zoning, and I'm a planner by profession, people put into place what they want to put into place, and then they utilize it the way that they want to achieve the goals that they want to achieve. So all of these things, whether it be zoning, whether it be the school system, whatever it is, you always have to look at who's in control of it and what their interests and goals are. Because it's going to play out on a lower level for the lower people a certain way in order for them to achieve what they want to achieve.
And then to a degree, we also see now with this housing crisis, which has actually been here since 2007, the unintended consequences, because I've been thinking about this, like more recently on CBS Morning News, there we were featured with Providence is now having the highest rental increase in the nation. Oh my goodness. And they had this nice white gentleman from working at Brown University who talked about his challenges of finding a place that he could afford to pay. And, you know, just talk about, again, he works for Brown. You would think that he'd be able to buy a house by now. He's living in a studio. That's the best he could find in terms of availability. And I said, you know, this is interesting that when I first got into that position with SBA, and we were talking about this housing crisis, we had a lot of long-term residents who could not afford to stay in the apartments. People were coming here, buying the properties, rehabbing them, raising the rents. Folks were being displaced, had to move away. And when we would talk to some of these other predominantly white neighborhood groups and associations, you know, they kind of nodded and just like, yeah, that's unfortunate. And then they were still spurring their focus and their goals of what we need to do. And I also can remember speaking with a former city council person talking about how we needed to diversify the tax base. Because I was like, why are we still focusing on luxury development, luxury homes, and it's high in price? I said, we need to mix this up. Why aren't we doing mixed income development? No, we need to diversify the tax base. I said, oh, yes, bring in predominantly wealthy people with higher incomes or higher cash assets to do what they have to do. And then, you know, also there's an article in Providence Business News, oh, Providence is the most undervalued city. So in 2019, we're talking about our values of the properties are just low. We really need to maximize this. And so you have Zillow and all of them perpetuating this. And then fast forward now, after you've had many black and brown folks who've been challenged and struggling to live here for 2007, now we got some good old white people who can't afford to live here, that now we have this crisis. So again, crisis. The valuing of whiteness in terms of the devaluing or disregard of black people is even seen right now in this focus and this discussion that we've been talking about, that black and brown folks have been talking about and saying, even going back to the financial crisis of 2008. But now we are at this moment that white people can't afford to live here, that we have this crisis that we now need to address. And like you said, now those developments are going into those neighborhoods where those who white people would be able to afford to live in.
And so it strikes me that through all of these stories, going back to urban renewal in Mount Hope, I mean, these themes are the same and woven through all of these stories and experiences and policies.
Patrick, if I could, I think that that's why these conversations that the church is hosting are so important, because if the general public doesn't see or isn't aware of these same themes running through all of these different ways that they play out, you don't see the long-term game that's being played. And one of the things that I say is very prominent amongst many folks in the indigenous community is what they did to the Indians, what they did to the black folks, they're now doing to everyone now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So the game and the intention has always been the taking of the land and the property. That's what it was from the very beginning. Europeans came over, wow, look at all of this. How do we get it? You start creating laws that don't allow Indians to hunt where they hunt anymore. You start creating laws that say that black folks can't own any property. All of these things are intended to get the maximum from these people with the least amount in return back. Then eventually, when these folks start getting together, you introduce this concept of race, because even if we look at a lot of our white identifying folks, a lot of their ancestors, when they got here, they weren't white.
Right.
Irish folk weren't white when they got here. Italians right. weren't white. So then you have to look at, if you weren't white when you got here, or your generations before weren't white, why are you identifying as white now if you're going to argue that there's no value to doing that? Of course there's a value to doing it, or you would not be identifying as it when your ancestors were oppressed as not being that. So you introduce the race element to divide these people who are having very similar circumstances, going through very similar things, and then you give a little bit more to these poorer, quote-unquote, white folks now, so that they feel a little bit better than these black and brown folks, so you can keep the divide going. But now you're at a point where you've taken so much from the black and brown folks, it's really not even worth your attention to pay attention to them anymore, because they don't have any political power or will, you know. So now who do you move on to? Well, you're moving on to the white folk who are at the lower end of the status of white folks. The individual who's at brown, well, yeah, you're at brown, but how much are you making at brown? Oh, so you're not one of the top earners at brown then. Oh, okay, well, we're going to slide you over here. Yeah, I know you're white. We know you're white, but you're not. And you can see what's starting to happen. So I encourage everyone, no matter what your racial identification is, look at the history of what has happened to black and brown folks in this country, in this state, and in this city, because that's what's coming for you next. And if we don't take a look at these things, and if we don't start to mitigate these things, you're going to be in one of those situations where all of the haves have everything, and the have-nots, regardless of what your skin tone is, have nothing. And then we'll still be fighting amongst ourselves over whose race, and while we have absolutely nothing. That is what I see taking place. And that's why I'm so adamant that things like urban renewal need to be understood by everyone, not just the folks that went through it, but everyone. Because if it can happen to us, if it can happen to my family, why can't it happen to you? Because you identify as white? Because you work at Brown, clearly that's not the case anymore.
So my question is there a way then to do a type of urban renewal or gentrification that actually does help the people in those neighborhoods? Because I know where I live, I go to all these like planning meetings and stuff, and I'm like, all I want is a coffee shop that I can walk to from my house, like the idea of Seven Star. Because there isn't one where I am. So, and that feels like something that wouldn't impact the neighborhood.
I want to say, yes, it is. The issue, and I said this, you know, a few months ago, I was on the panel. Are you willing to give up power? Because if you're willing to give up power and control of how the process goes and willing to have an outcome that is not directly or immediately financially beneficial to you, then yes, you can have that process. So, for example, when you had the issue with St. Joseph's Hospital back in 2017, when the Paolino Properties wanted to utilize that as a place for housing of homeless folks, and many in the community, again, because of zoning, you had a lot of the social services and housing dedicated to those folks based and concentrated in Broad Street in the areas of South Providence. And our argument was, wait a minute, if this is a citywide issue, statewide issue, the whole city and the whole state needs to participate in. We cannot be the go-to place for everything. And we now need to have other communities participate in that. But part of that, where if that project did not go through, but the question of the community was like, okay, what else use can that building be, mm-hmm. go through? And so we were able to challenge and have the zoning change for that building where there were certain types of businesses that cannot operate out of that building, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. the way in which it, how it was zoned, its use was changed. Mm-hmm. So yes, you can. And ultimately, you know, the building, they've been thinking about what other uses they can do it. Ultimately now, the owners want to just sell that property to whoever will take it and do whatever they can. They'll take their loss. But yes, you can have that process where, and I, as a marketing major, I apply those skills of understanding your customer, knowing your target audience in the market to really set up things for that benefit them. Yet you have to be willing to not be in control. Mm-hmm. And you have to be willing to accept that they may have something that you don't envision. And that's mm-hmm. another problem with these developers. They come and they already have their plans ready to go. Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. want black and brown folks, prominent people. I get this, Dwayne. We want to talk to SBNA about this. Oh, you have something already in place that you mm-hmm. want me to co-sign for. Mm-hmm. Not that you want mm-hmm. me to really be engaged and mm-hmm. find out what I want and what I need. You already have decided for yourself. We're not talking to anybody else. Mm-hmm. But now that you know that I'm someone who is loud enough where your stuff may not go through, mm-hmm. and I do have a track record that when I really want to oppose something, stuff don't go through, or you will go through a lot to get, mm-hmm. make it happen, that all of a sudden, well, you know, let's see how we can make this work. No. Mm-hmm. The moment your idea comes in your head, that's when you're supposed to have that conversation.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. And the moment that happens, and then this is another thing, we talk about racism, but with this, there's also elitism and classism.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'll go to Dwayne, the person with the MBA,
yeah.
but Dwayne's next door neighbor who may not speak the way I speak, yeah. or may not conduct myself in the same yeah. way, well, that rabble rouser, we ain't going to deal with them. So yeah. we'll deal with certain folks yeah. as well. Still continuing that exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So you still have a number of black and brown folks still yeah. excluded from these processes.
Yeah.
It's still happening.
And do you see that, and this might be out of pocket, so I pre-apologize, but with the, like, Learn 365 and the COVID funds and the community centers?
Oh, absolutely.
Such a quick response. Oh,
this was a conversation among my community. This is, like, the first time they've been so proactive in making sure that our community is at the forefront. So no one trusted it. That was, remember yeah. they were saying what they couldn't get? That's what it was. It's like, why are they so adamant that we need to be at the forefront of this? And I think you're dealing with a tremendous dose of skepticism from certain communities because of the history of it. And I want to say this as well. I really take my hat off to Dwayne, because from the first time I met Dwayne, we met through our involvement with the Rhode Island Young Professionals. He's been exactly the individual he is sitting right here having this conversation on this podcast. And I like the fact, I appreciate the fact that he's bringing up how so many individuals who come from black and brown communities come here, but they're not actually connecting with the black and brown communities here.
Mm.
They're pretty much a part of the status quo,
mm-hmm.
and they're not gonna mess up their progress or their position just because someone looks like them. So I encourage everyone, when you're looking at policies, don't assume because you see someone who looks like the people that are being impacted that they necessarily represent the interest of the people that are being impacted. Look at how they themselves have conducted themselves, how what networks they have plugged themselves into, and what they have stood up for. And I think that I know that when you look at Dwayne, like he said, he's a Rhode Islander because he's at the forefront. There's been so many times and I'm at something arguing or protesting as someone who's generational, and there's Dwayne as well. And then we're having a conversation and Dwayne's letting me know what he's been up to and I'm letting him know what I've been up to. And then this is the spaces we're going to connect that, but each of us moving in our own space and in our own regard. So I take my hat off to Dwayne, sir. If I haven't said it publicly, I think I have. But thank you for your commitment to our community here. And yes, I think that all of these, there's not anything that comes along that's a government policy that I don't take two or three looks at. Because I'm like, okay. And like Dwayne, you're coming and you're speaking to me. Why? Why are you reaching out to me? How far along in your process are you already along? And haven't you learned yet that I'm not going to rub it? As a matter of fact, why are you telling me this? Because I'm going to go and tell everyone this is what you're up to. So don't come and talk to me. Save yourself the headache. Or, like Dwayne said, come and speak to me at the very beginning, knowing that I can plug you into the people you need to speak to make this happen.
And also being direct and honest. Because a part of me was like, when you mentioned the COVID funds, oh, the U.S. Treasury require you to have community engagement. Okay, that makes sense. Because I'm sitting here like, oh, you want to have you want me to host? Why? You know who I am, right? Oh, you need to fulfill this federal requirement, which you really should have been doing all this time, but you didn't. But now we got to get this money. We got to spend it because, again, if you don't do this or earmark it for spending by a certain day, you lose it. Right. So, again, going back to that capitalism, we got this money. We got this opportunity. We got to get this through. And serving as a member of the Providence Municipal Reparations Commission along with Raymond, again, great concept, great ideas. But when it came time to let's move this money forward with the disbursements, and I could not understand the rush for it until afterwards. Oh, we got a certain time limit. We got a certain way in which we got to get this money on out, and it needs to be designated for certain particular people. So even within this cycle, still the aspect of capital is showing up here. So the racism, the arm, the impact is still rooted within the capitalist structure. It's just playing out with these government funding.
And once again, to Dwayne's point, we're now being engaged because it's a requirement. So I think that that's where, if we're looking at changes on a policy level, those are some of the things that can and should be done, requirements. And I think that they are done on face value, but they need to be looked at more in-depthly. Requirements on what needs to be done in order for these dollars to be spent. That when you look back at urban renewal, I doubt that there was any sort of requirement that they fully engaged with the communities that they were going to target to get their input on any project. I think they just developed it, went and got the rubber stamp from a few people and moved forward with it. And that's very problematic. So if we're talking from a policy perspective, I think it's looking at what requirements should go along with the spending of these dollars, how they utilize time frames and all that. I did want to touch base when you talked about, you know, if things could be done. Yeah, because I think that that's essentially what good community development is. So there's a whole, I got a degree in it, community development and planning. But that's what good community development is. It's speaking to the community as a whole, valuing everyone's input, and then making a decision that is beneficial to everyone, but focuses on where the problematic areas are going to be so that you mitigate them proactively and effectively. And I think what the problem is, we just don't have really good community development or really good community planning here. And I think that bad community development and bad community planning is what gentrification is. That's what displacement is. Because there's some planning that goes along with it. There's a development strategy with it. This is just the outcome of it. So one of the things that I've suggested, and I'm trying to, because I just haven't had the time to really dig into it, but one of the things that I thought, because you spoke about wanting to have a seven stars. Well, the issue is...
I don't want a seven stars. No, I want a nice coffee shop.
But even the problem with having a nice coffee shop, say like on a Camp Street or on a South Providence, is that the value of that coffee shop now affects the homes that are next to it. If I'm a property owner who's just barely making it on my mortgage and just barely making it on taxes, do I want that nice coffee? So now the whole community suffers because if we bring something nice here, I'm going to lose my home. So one of the suggestions I have, and when we, and this is where I think we tie in what Dwayne said about giving up power. We don't have to have the tax structure that we have now. We have it because it benefits certain people. So my suggestion is, what if we were to look at a tax restructure where you valued people's properties on the value of their property, but my property is not valued on the value of your property next to me? So if I have a three-family home and I do some upgrades to it, I'm going to get taxed more on the value of my property and my upgrades, But my neighbor next to me isn't. They're going to get taxed based on the value of their property. Mm. Now, you can move a nice coffee shop next to my home because the value of that coffee shop is not going to impact my home. Mm. I might now, however, because more people are coming around, say, hey, I don't want my house looking horrible next to this coffee and do some investments in it, but I'm not kicked out of my neighborhood because you're adding more developments in it. So to Dwayne's point, yeah, these things can happen, but are the people who have the power and the influence willing to give up some of that so that these things can happen more effectively? And there is the whole problem. At the end of the day, the problem is always going to be the people. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, no matter what policy you put in place, no matter what the language says, how are the people in power with the ability to make it happen letting that play out?
I mean, we saw that in 2019 with the property rebound process, where you had, for the most part, not all of 02906, but the majority of it, where the property value stayed the same, in some cases decline, versus Mount Hope and other parts of the city where the property values increased 25, 50, 75%. Right. And then you have this imbalance of the tax structure going here. And I remember going to planning and saying, wait a minute, you have this map that shows these places where you had these increases. And then I compared it to the map about a year before that had these areas of that vacant, abandoned, and deteriorating properties. And I said, how is it these areas where you have these deteriorating homes, the values, real estate, don't match up to it, all of a sudden had these substantial increases? And these are your maps, your sources that are showing this. And I remember then being serving on that special commission to study a progressive tier property tax. And I remember right before COVID and our meetings were stopped, I said, we need to investigate the tax assessor's office and their practices. Mm-hmm. And what are they doing? And how are we getting these values? And I remember no one told me I was lying. Mm-hmm. No one said, Wayne, you're wrong. Because I was like, show me the receipts. Mm-hmm. Show me those stuff. But then I remember catching on like, yes, this is intentional. Mm-hmm. It's intentional. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is on purpose. Mm-hmm. This was not by accident. Mm-hmm. They did that or allowed that to happen that has led to what we're seeing today with this housing crisis.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else either of you want to add? Anything we've missed? I feel like I could throw out any word and you'd be like, yes, this is how it connects. But is there any sort of final thoughts or feelings or next steps people should take? I always like a next step.
I mean, I've always said this. If you're engaging and listening, having these conversations on a regular basis, then you're not going to be surprised. Mm-hmm. And you'll be able to deal with this because you're being proactive of knowing this information. So what I would say to listeners is, yes, follow this information, research, read on your own, start asking questions. Start talking to those folks who you may have known about their experiences in addressing this. Find out more. And then also be prepared to start asking the questions like we ask. Like, the reason why we're in the position is that as if something doesn't sound right, we start going to ask some questions. Mm-hmm. And then more importantly, don't be afraid. I always say this too. I'm going to make somebody mad when I say this. Don't be afraid to make somebody mad with making these statements. Because this is how we do heal. This is part of this process of coming together, of becoming a beloved community, of showing God's love and kindness there. Mm-hmm. We got to be honest. Jesus wasn't always nice when he said what he had to say. And yet, he was also still loving in doing so. And we can do the same.
Yeah. I add on to what Dwayne said, speaking about Jesus. He was killed for what he was saying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as Christians, you know, if your concern is more so with not rocking the boat, then are you actually following in the footsteps of Jesus? Because Jesus said what was right, and they took his life because of it. Beyond that, I'm reminded, and I'm not going to say it correctly, but there's this poem. It's a very famous poem, and they say, you know, first they came for... It's that same sort of thing that's going on right now, and I think we're seeing it play out right now. It was just the Negroes at first. and their properties were getting taken, and they had policies that were stripping them of their lands, you know, and that didn't really impact me, you know. And then it was the Negroes who had, you know, drugs and all of that sort of stuff, and that didn't really impact me, you know. And then it's not just the Negroes anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. So at what point does society as a whole say, we can't keep just saying, well, that's their problem? Because eventually, if we keep saying that's just their problem, it's going to be my problem. And for all of those folks that are out there who are starting to feel the squeeze now, study the history of what took place with urban renewal. If you don't want to go all the way back to slavery, if that's too big of an issue for your mind to deal with, fine. Just look at the experiences of the black and brown communities from urban renewal on and look for the shared themes throughout all of them. And you'll be able to see where the story's going if we don't do something to address it. Change can always happen. The country stopped slavery. Mm-hmm. The biggest cash crop for, you know, it stopped slavery because enough people said enough's enough. Change can always happen. Is the spirit for change powerful enough, and especially amongst the church, to make change happen? And if Christians, of all people, can't be the ones at the forefront of change that is for the betterment of our community, then in my opinion, what real hope is there? If the Christians can't be the ones to start to initiate and move it forward and challenge the system, then what type of Christians are they being? So yes, there's always opportunity for change, but it starts with being informed, it starts with being understanding, and then it starts with removing oneself from the center of the equation and saying, who should be centered here, and what can I add to the pot that helps to change the situation for everyone? And I think that you all, as I said, are doing a really great job of doing your part by having these dialogues. And in my people's language, we say, thank you for listening. I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts. And I look forward to seeing what the feedback is on these conversations that you're having.
Thank you so much. And if we wanted to stay connected with your work, how would we do that?
Sure. So, of course, the website, www.provcei.org. You can find us on social media, on IG and Facebook as well, at Providence Cultural Equity Initiative. And you can follow me on my Facebook as well, Raymond L. Watson. I kind of live on there. So anything I have going on, I'm usually just tossing it out there. But yeah, there's definitely ways to stay in touch with the work we're doing at PCEI.
Absolutely. And if we wanted to stay in touch with the work you all are doing at Church of the Redeemer, where would we connect?
Oh, we definitely do have our own website as well. We're also on social media, both Facebook and I believe also Instagram as well.
We are indeed.
Yes. So definitely Church of the Redeemer, follow our work, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you all so much for listening to this season of Tea Time Theology.
I'm going there to see my Father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over home. I'm going there to see Savior, to sing his praise forevermore. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over home.
Thank you for listening to Tea Time Theology, a ministry of St. John's Cathedral in Rhode Island. We would like to thank our producers, Ivy Swinsky and Taylor Wilkie. Special thanks to Mario Akande and David Hines for this season's music. Additionally, we would like to thank Dwayne Keyes for co-hosting this season, and the Reverend Patrick Campbell for consulting this season. Our sponsor, the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island, and the Right Reverend Nicholas Nisley, as well as our guests today. Follow us at Tea Time Theology on all social medias.